sitting at the table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
And protection.
Fairness.
Fair trial.
Right.
Well.
Peace.
Movement.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
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 Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Focus.
Culture.
Human rights.
Dr. Dana.
Solid.
Fill in the border. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on Sastel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. I'm Jim Hutchings with my special guests, Crystal Giesbrecht and Samila Farah Ali. Welcome, and we'll start, I think, with Samia.
Hello, my name is Samia Ali. I'm a grade 12 student at Campbell Collegiate, and I've been involved with Amnesty since about last year. Today, I'm really excited to interview Crystal Giesbrecht, who is the Director of Members, Programs, and Services at the Provincial Association of Transition Houses and Services of Saskatchewan, also known as PATHS. PATHS is a provincial association for 21 shelters and counseling agencies that provide services to victims of intimate partner violence in Saskatchewan. Crystal is also an Amnesty International field worker and a member of Regina's local Amnesty International Group 91. Crystal and her colleagues recently traveled to the Netherlands to attend the Third World Conference of Women's Shelters, and she is here to tell us some of what she's learned there. So first, Crystal, can you tell us about the significance of the song that was just played?
Yes, that was a clip from The Veiled Monologues. And what The Veiled Monologues is a Dutch actor who had performed in Eve Ensler's The Vagina Monologues, who, she was from the Netherlands. She approached Muslim women living there to ask them similar questions, and their stories were turned into a compilation of dramatic monologues, dance, and live music. One of the actors sang and performed one of the monologues at the opening ceremonies, and I was also able to view the whole performance later in the conference. So that clip was just a small piece of the song from that performance.
Can you tell us about the conference that you attended?
Yes, so myself and Joanne Duzel, who is PATH's provincial coordinator, both had the good fortune to be able to attend the Third World Conference of Women's Shelters. This conference is where those involved in the violence against women movement, largely frontline shelter staff, meet to share experiences from their countries. The first one was held in Alberta, and the second one, which I also had the good fortune to attend, was held in Washington, D.C., and this one was held in The Hague, Netherlands. In attendance were over 1,000 participants, 95% of them were women, and they came from 115 countries around the world.
Wow, what was the format like of the conference?
It was over 4 days, and there were a number of plenary sessions with panels and keynote speakers that all 1,000 of us attended. And the program was really extensive. I'm sure there was at least 80 different breakout sessions to choose from throughout the conference. Some of the impressive individuals who were there to speak to us were Her Majesty Queen Maxima of the Netherlands, Her Royal Highness Crown Princess Mary of Denmark, and Ashley Judd, who of course is an actor and is known for her feminist activism. And there were really just so many inspiring speakers that I really never would have had the chance to hear had it not been for this conference. There was a women's rights lawyers and advocates from Pakistan and Iraq, women from national and regional women's shelter networks across the world, a number of officials from the Netherlands and elsewhere, such as Australia and South Africa. Rashida Manju, who was the former UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, as well as Dubravka Simonovic, who is the current UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women. There was heads of safety and policy for Google and Facebook, and importantly, staff from many organizations from all over the world who are doing work similar to the work that we do at PATHS.
What was your, in your opinion, what was the most powerful part of the conference?
There were so many things that were really powerful, but there's a few examples that I want to tell you about. One speaker who was really captivating was Dr. Dennis Mukwege, and he is known as the man who mends women. He was just absolutely phenomenal. He built a hospital in the Democratic Republic of Congo where he specializes in the treatment of women who have been gang raped by rebel forces. Dr. Mukwege has treated thousands of women as well as children who were victims of rape in conflict. He has seen some of those women more than once, and he performs up to 10 surgeries a day during 18-hour working days. He talked during his speech about how young women survivors stay at the shelter afterwards for 6 months and have the opportunity to learn skills. And he talked a lot about why he's doing this work, and he's working to have rape in conflict banned. And Dr. Mukwege has been the recipient of many, many awards for his work, but he's also been the victim of an assassination attempt, and he receives regular threats because of his work. So he talked about living in his hospital for protection, and he's still there, and he's still doing this powerful work. That was just absolutely amazing to hear and just really inspiring. And a couple others that really stuck with me. One was Rashida Manju, the former UN Special Rapporteur, and she was just fantastic. During her talk, the audience interrupted her multiple times to applaud, and she talked about the importance of viewing violence against women through a human rights lens, and she commented that around the world, we see NGOs we see cuts to funding for NGOs and women's programs, but we do not see cuts to military budgets. And another thing that I think will resonate with you as Amnesty members was the current UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women also covered topics such as the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. She talked about CEDAW, which is the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, and the Istanbul Convention, which, of course, as you know, is called that for short because what it stands for is the Council of Europe Convention on Preventing and Combating Violence Against Women and Domestic Violence. And the point that she stressed was that we need to see clear success in achieving gender equality if we want to see a reduction in violence against women in the next 15 years.
You also had the opportunity to visit a Dutch woman's shelter while you were there. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was such a fantastic experience to be able to do that. So one of the breakout sessions that I signed up for was this field trip to a women's shelter. And myself and a bunch of women from all over the world got on a couple buses and went to visit this shelter. And we actually, it was really cool because there was multiple parts to the tour they gave us. So the shelter, it had a lot of similarities to what we do in Canada in terms of how the building was set up and everything like that, space for the children, you know, communal cooking area and all of that. But it was really neat because it was an old monastery. So it was this big old brick building and it had a courtyard in the middle so that the women had this garden and it was safe in there. It was in the center so they could spend time in this garden. But the really neat thing was that it's apartments, so they have their separate own living space and they can stay there for up to 6 months. So that's really innovative. And that's something that sheltering is turning to in a lot of places, if the buildings and the funding available is there. But that's something that works really, really well for helping survivors to get a fresh start. So that was impressive. And as well as the shelter part, we also met the staff from an outreach program that work with women in high-risk situations. They also work with families who are staying together and where violence is a problem. They go into the home, they intervene, they make sure all the family members have supports and work on ending the violence and meeting the family where they're at, which is really quite quite innovative and quite different. So that was interesting to hear their perspective. And the third thing about that tour to the women's shelter was they also have a men's shelter. And we met the staff from there. And then one of the male survivors who is currently living in the shelter came out to talk to us. And that shelter is for men who are victims of domestic violence and also human trafficking, so sex trafficking or forced labor trafficking. So it was just, that was really fascinating because we don't have a service like that here in this province or nearby. So really interesting to hear how they approach it. And we were able to ask them questions. And then they had this lovely reception where the shelter clients and their children came and they had made this food. And then we got to talk to them and mingle. So really powerful.
Can you give us some examples of challenges that women and the women's shelter movement had to overcome in other countries?
Yeah, there was lots of things that are just so different from what we deal with here in Canada. So one thing that I learned was that in Iraq, orphans of war don't have legal status, which leaves teenage girls vulnerable to trafficking and exploitation. The government also doesn't give legal status to shelters, so they must operate illegally, which they do because they're providing this really, really important service to protect women and young girls, and they do it, but they don't have the permits to actually be running those services. But, you know, they're so brave and they do it anyway. And that was really interesting. And another couple examples came from Morocco. So there, they talked about changing the law that previously allowed rapists to avoid penalty by marrying their victim. And in Morocco, they also started the first illegal women's shelter. And what they meant by it being illegal was that shelters had to report when women were staying there, which, of course, is nonsensical, right? You tell the family or the perpetrator of the abuse that a woman's in the shelter, she's not going to be safe. And so they started operating illegally and not reporting when women were staying with them, which, again, very, very brave to do that in a country like Morocco. And since, they advocated to have the legislation changed, and now it's no longer that way. But those were really, really inspiring because here in Canada, we do similar work in the shelter movement in terms of protecting women and children, but we have overcome some of these things, or we didn't have, you know, we didn't have some of those oppressive laws in the first place. So really inspiring to see people are doing the work that we're doing, but sometimes under so much more difficult circumstances and in the face of so much more oppression.
What are the most important things that you have brought back from to your work?
One thing that was really exciting to us was new knowledge on how domestic violence impacts survivors on what they can do in the workplace. So, for example, when women are experiencing violence in home, it can affect their ability to concentrate at work, to show up on time, to be focused and be part of the team. And sometimes that can lead to them having penalties and their employment suffering. And if people don't realize what's going on, then the victim doesn't receive the supports that she needs. So something that was really important was some presentations and a panel on why companies should be involved and examples from other countries where that work is currently being done, including a presentation by some Canadian colleagues. And that's really important because PATHS is currently engaged in a program partnered with unions and funded by the Status of Women Canada to work on that exact same topic. And another thing that was really important to me was I attended a fantastic workshop on trauma-informed practice, which was presented by a panel of shelter workers from Alberta, Ontario, and Kentucky. And those women all talked about their processes of renovating or rebuilding their shelters and what they did to make their physical spaces that the clients stay in more trauma-informed. And again, that was really important to me, as trauma-informed practice is something that PATHS and our member agencies are currently focusing on implementing here in the province.
Is PATHS going to do something else this upcoming year?
Yeah, so a lot of what we're working on now is supporting our members to improve the work that we do with our clients, and a lot of that revolves around trauma-informed practice and improving best practice in shelter services. So when we do, when we attend things like this conference, we come back with so many ideas and so many things that then we can implement all of those ideas into the stuff that we do. And in my role at PATHS, I do so much research and training and resource development and stuff like that to support all of our 21 member agencies in the province. So this just gives us so many ideas and all of the stuff that now we can roll out and pass along to them.
What happens now going forward after the conference?
So what happens now is we're working on disseminating the information that was gathered at the conference to our members, as I mentioned, and incorporating all of that new knowledge into our work here. But something globally that will happen going forward that's really important is at the end of the conference, a call for action was formed. So the call to action details the seriousness of the situation of violence against women and girls around the world. And it calls upon key stakeholders to strengthen efforts to prevent violence and to effectively protect women and girls. So specifically, this call to action document calls for signing, ratifying, and effectively implementing relevant conventions, providing adequate funding, redirecting military spending, implementing a standalone convention on violence against women, which is internationally binding, and holding perpetrators to account. The document also contains specific calls for each region of the world. And that call to action is available on the worldshelterconference.org website. And if people are interested, that website is really, really good because this call to action document is available there. But there's a whole bunch of videos, including the one that we played the clip from the song from at the beginning. But some of the keynote speakers it's there, and there's all these videos and resources, and they were very good about sharing the presentations so that you go there and you absorb all this information, but then you've got it to review and go over when you get back home. But then not just for us who were there, but for everyone else, they can still hear those speeches and get that information as well.
I was wondering, do you think there are any ways that the youth can get involved with this cause?
Yeah, you know, I think so, because with ending violence against women, it's such a huge topic, and I think the solution is just so multifaceted. So what we're doing now, you have to help the people where violence has already impacted their lives, which is what PATHS member agencies do. In the shelters and the counseling centers across the province, they support women and children that have already experienced violence. Likewise with the justice system and the programs for perpetrators of violence. And that's important for helping people to exit that cycle of violence and end the violence in their lives. But really, the way that we're going to change things is to prevent violence. And that's where the youth have a specific role. Because what we need to do is change the culture and change the way people think about violence and people's understanding of violence against women and girls as a serious social issue that affects all of us. So for every person, but especially for youth, I think it's really important to kind of live that principle every day. So something that is important in our work and throughout, you know, with all of these agencies involved in this conference, is the concept of being a positive bystander. So if you hear something that's inappropriate or you see something that's inappropriate, say something about it in a way that you're comfortable and a way that doesn't put yourself at risk, but to stand up and be part of the change or say, you know, I don't agree with that. And that's how we're going to slowly change the discourse and change the way people think about it. But being positive examples, I think, getting out there and living in a healthy way and trying to educate others about healthy relationships, because a lot of it is just we have to undo a lot of negative kind of social norms and ideas that people have about women and girls and about violence in relationships. And I think that can only come from the next generation. That can only come from youth. So if we have more people like yourself and of your generation that are taking that cause on and being part of it, then we're going to get somewhere. And it might not be in this generation, but we've seen in the last 30 years, things have got better in this country. So it's only going to keep getting better the more of us that join in and keep doing this work, I think.
I have a question.
Yes.
One thing that you said that had me a little puzzled, what is trauma-informed practice?
Oh, yes. That is a really good question, and I should have defined that. So trauma-informed practice is the idea of working with victims, understanding that they've experienced trauma and the way that they're experiencing what's happened to them and sort of their reactions and the ways that they're coping is because of the trauma and what they've experienced. So basically, it's not, in our work, it's not our role to diagnose trauma or PTSD, but we have to understand the really serious impacts that trauma has on individuals. And we as frontline violence against women advocates, we have to be sure that we work in this way and that we train others, such as the police and the justice system and all of that, to be informed of the impact of trauma. Because what will happen is the people we've worked with, they've all experienced trauma to some extent. Most of the people walking around out in the community, many have experienced trauma. And sometimes it's something, you know, sometimes it was one event, but for so many people, it's been multiple traumas over the course of their life. And for some people, that comes from intergenerational trauma. We're looking especially for people of Indigenous ancestry, and in this country, we have the legacy of residential schools and all of that. And we really want to look at people's context and make sure that we are meeting people where they're at, essentially, and serving them in a way that's that's not oppressive and can help to help them to give them what they need in a way that works for them while being mindful of what they've experienced.
Mm-hmm. I'm just, when you say that and we're mentioning police, I'm just wondering, is that part of police training now to be aware of how the trauma is going to affect the people that they're interacting with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, it is. And I can say that because PATHS is actually involved in doing that. We do some training for the RCMP and also for the police college. So they get training on domestic violence and on working with victims elsewhere in their program. We just do a very small presentation for them. But we do have the option to talk, or the opportunity, I should say, to talk to them about this stuff, because it's really important for us to be able to say that sometimes when you meet individuals who've experienced violence, it doesn't always look like how you think it's going to look. And sometimes people's reactions or the way they behave may seem unexpected, or, you know, not what you might think someone who's experienced violence would be behaving like. And sometimes that's trauma. And it's really important to be aware of those things, and then to talk about how do you appropriately work with people who've experienced trauma, to work with them in a way that's appropriate and accepting and doesn't re-traumatize them, and mostly makes them feel comfortable and like they can reach out and seek help.
Well, that takes us to the bottom of the hour. And this is Human Rights Radio. I'm Jim Hutchings, and we're speaking with Crystal Giesbrecht and Samiha Farah Ali. And we will be right back after this break, and we've got some special music to play for you.
I raise my arms to the sky. On my knees I pray. I'm not afraid anymore. I will walk
You know, I was just trying to think where I've heard that rhythm before, and it just occurred to me where I've heard it. A Shakira-type song, right?
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, that's what it reminded me of.
It reminds me of something, too, and I don't know what song, though.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you guys what song that is. So that song we chose for the break because it's significant to the World Conference of Women's Shelters. The song is called Break the Chain, and it was produced by Eve Ensler and V-Day. And that song is from the 1 Billion Rising movement, which they do on V-Day, which is February 14th every year. There's a choreography that goes with that song.
And Eve Ensler is the person
that
wrote
the Vagina Monologues author. That's right. So Eve Ensler started this V-Day movement, and they do this 1 Billion Rising dance on February 14th all around the world. And if you go on YouTube, you see videos, and it's like people in the Philippines doing this choreography and people in Canada and all over the world. It's really cool. But they did it at the conference. The woman from 1 Billion Rising was there, and she led the choreography up on the stage. And then they got all 1,000 of us in our seats to stand up and follow along and do this choreography.
Wow.
And we're in our seats trying to do it. But it was really cool because that broke a record for 1 Billion Rising. That was the most people from the most countries doing it at once, because there was 115 countries participating.
Wow. Sounds like fun.
It was.
It must have been an amazing experience. So what was it like to be in a room with all these women?
It was so powerful and so much fun, because you do the work all the time, and it's easy to get wrapped up, and you just do your day-to-day work, and you're going through your to-do list and supporting your local community. But to go and meet all of these people who are doing the exact same thing in across the world, it's really inspiring, it's really empowering, and I think everyone there just had such a sense of solidarity, because you're reminded of how many of us there are doing the same thing, working with the same goals. And so that's just really inspiring as it is. But then you also come away really, really energized, because there's all these new exciting ideas, and you see people overcoming these obstacles and doing these really innovative things. And you come home going, yeah, we can do that. We can do that too. And you have all this inspiration and energy to do new things.
What I find fascinating is what you're doing here now legally is against the law in some countries.
Oh, absolutely.
It's very strange.
We have such good fortune here in this country. Things, I mean, obviously are not perfect, and we have a very long way to go, but we are so lucky that we can operate our services legally, and that we have government funding and government support to do what we do and to help victims of violence. And you're really reminded of that when you go to a conference like this, because while we're all working on the same issues, some of the things they're dealing with in other countries are things like getting the law to recognize that rape is a crime, or that forced marriage is a crime. Things mm-hmm. that we're past here, or that, you know, that we have already overcome with our laws and legislation.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, one of the things that you were telling us about as well is that the doctor that fixes women, how is it, like, I'm just wondering why his life is being threatened, and he's had an assassination attempt. What's going on there? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know if I can answer your question completely, but something that is just, this is horrifying and shocking and depressing, but something that I learned hearing Dr. Dennis Mukwege speak was that rape in conflict happens as a kind of cultural genocide. So when victims are raped, they are sometimes injured so badly that they will not be able to bear children. And this happens to women, and it happens to children. And it's done as this form of cultural genocide with the goal of wiping out a group of people. And he talked about that, and I hadn't known that, or I hadn't realized mm-hmm, it. I thought that rape and conflict was just about power and control and violence and all of that. So I think because of his work and all of the surgeries he's performing, and that he's helping these women get well and rejoin the community and essentially thwarting the plan of those who are committing these atrocities. I think that's what's made him so unpopular, and it's put his life at risk. Mm-hmm. He has a family, and so for a while, Dr. Mukwege fled and he went to Europe. And there was this big loss in the Congo, and the people really missed him, and they wanted him to come back because they needed him. There's such a need for the services he provides. So he eventually came back, and then he was welcomed, and there was this celebration when he came back to the Congo. And I believe now he actually stays in his hospital, and he lives there for wow. safety. Just absolutely amazing. And he was just great, because besides just doing the surgeries, which he does for 18 hours a day some days, but he's also talking about systemic change. And instead of just helping these victims now, the process or the practice of rape and conflict needs to be ended. And I think that's too where he's putting his life on the line, because he's speaking out about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, in reference to the call to action, what were some of the things that are going to happen in these different areas of the world?
Yeah, I'll tell you what some of them are, because it's really, I have a bit of a list here, and I'll share them with you, because it's so interesting that we're working on the same things across the world, but then there's these specifics in different countries. So I'll tell you what some of them are. So in the Inter-Americas, and that's the region here that we're in Canada, what our group wanted to focus on was providing sustainable funding for women's services, working with women and girls during and after armed conflict, creating special international measures for exceptional violence against women in organized crime territories, and also strengthening international cooperation. And those are things, I mean, those themes do resonate across the world. And you see very similar things in some of the other regions. Many of them, of course, talked about ensuring sufficient and stable funding for shelters, strengthening political will to keep funding these services and supporting them. But some of the other things that are specifically interesting are in Asia, something that's really important to them is ensuring economic empowerment through funding employment and housing programs for women. And something that's really important in Asia is to give women equal property rights, so rights to inheritance, so that women are allowed, so that they would have property and they would have that financial stability and independence should they want to exit a relationship, which of course is not an issue that we're dealing with here in our country.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe, they are really concerned with ratifying the Istanbul Convention in all countries and implementing CEDAW, and especially the Article 6 of CEDAW, which is on trafficking and prostitution, is something that's really important there. And and other things that are kind of interesting, too.
I'm just curious, at this point, our country, Canada, has a record of being a little slow ratifying some of the protocols. I'm just wondering how they're doing on these fronts.
I think on these fronts, Canada is, we're doing better than in some regions of the world, mm-hmm. but we certainly have more
really?
To do. You know,
okay.
there's always more that can be done, and we certainly have some more things we can push to. But I think that we're getting there. You know, I think that we're in a spot where we're going to see some positive change on the front of ending women violence against women. So mm-hmm. so that's exciting and positive, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Did technology come into the discussion?
Yeah, actually, that's something really interesting to talk about, because the topic of technology and how it impacts violence against women came up in a few different ways during the conference. So one thing that that they had was a panel discussion on violence against women and how technology impacts it. And so that on that panel, they had Emma Murphy, if you know who she is. She's a survivor who was a victim of violence, and after this assault happened, she made a video talking about her experience, like right after, and she was going to leave the abusive relationship. She posted it on Facebook. That video was shared 9 million times. Wow. And now she gets letters from people all over the world saying, mm-hmm. you know, you inspired me to do the same. And so she was there talking about the power of social media. There was Ashley Judd, who talks about the enormous amount of really awful, misogynistic hate messages, like terrible stuff that she gets on the internet every day, and kind of her process of having to deal with that and sift through that, because it's very hard to filter those things that mm-hmm. come anonymously through the internet. And then others on this panel, there was Google and Facebook, which was, I think, really impressive that they had some of their higher level people there to talk really honestly about what the issues are, because some of it is, okay, the user is responsible for their privacy settings and how they interact and how they use these tools. But also, what is the company's responsibility for making sure those things are safe and for protecting victims or helping them if there's a problem while using that platform? So they were there, as well as some really important people from big organizations that are doing work with technology and violence against women in Australia and the States. But one thing that I thought was really interesting was said by Cindy Southwith, who's from NNEDV, and that's the organization in the States. But what she said was that technology is involved in violence, in sexual violence, in harassment, in stalking, but this isn't a new phenomenon. She said misogyny is still misogyny. Tech is just a new tool through which to enact misogyny. And that's so true. It just gives perpetrators of abuse and of violence this one more tool in their toolkit, so mm-hmm. to speak. And her organization is doing a lot of education around how to help people use technology safely. And that's, again, this is something that's really huge in my work and with our member agencies, because the women we work with, they are going to use cell phones. They're going to use Facebook. They're going to use Google, because these are your connection to the outside world. If you're in a women's shelter, you can use, if you have a free Wi-Fi connection, you can connect with friends and family on Facebook. You know, these are useful tools to help people stay connected and to get the support that they need. But it can be very dangerous if you're not informed about your privacy settings and how to control those things. So that was something that that was really interesting, I think, to us, is that whole debate between, you know, what's like the individual responsibility and then what's kind of the company's responsibility to protect their users. And it was really neat to have Ashley Judd's comments on that. So that was just exciting, because I think in every region of the world, this is an issue. There's nowhere where we aren't seeing these hugely increased rates of stalking and harassment and online violence. This is a new phenomenon, and we're having mm-hmm. to kind of catch up and learn how to battle that, I think.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see technology as a medium for sharing those stories and inspiring people. And I know some countries don't have that ability. Some people in those countries don't have that ability. But for example, in South Asia, I know that they're really focusing on this, like bringing social media and technology into raising awareness of the things that women face and the difficulties that they face.
Yes, you're right. And I'm so glad you said that, because that's the thing, like for the negative that can come from social media and from technology, I think there's way more positive. Look at how much good has come from things like you've said about using social media to create awareness about the things that women experience. How much has been changed just by some of the campaigns, like the hashtags about believing victims of sexual violence, the hashtag why I left, hashtag why I stayed. It allows us at PATHS to reach out to our members, to contact new people. We can interact with donors, with people who need help. It's just, there's so much positive, but yeah, like learning to use it safely and educating people. It's a really interesting thing.
Just like to ask Samia what your background is. You've been asking questions here, but it's now time for you to answer some. You're a high school student. What's your sort of involvement in all this all these things that we've been talking about?
Well, my background, so I'm from Bangladesh. I came here 10 years ago, about 10 years ago, and currently I'm attending Campbell Collegiate, and there since grade 9, I got involved with the Social Justice Club, and that club really focused on lots of issues around the world. One of them was the violence against women, and that's something that I've been looking at. And right now I'm the president of the club, so I've been thinking about how to raise awareness of those kind of issues in my school and how to take action as high schoolers.
So what sort of things has the club been doing?
So far we did a food drive for the food bank, and we're planning on doing things for the arrival of the Syrian refugees.
Wow, awesome. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, it's so impressive to have a social justice club in high school. And I think back now and think, why didn't I do that when I was in school? I'm just so impressed by it.
I feel like I was living in a bubble when I was in high school, but that was a very long time ago. Yeah. Crystal, you were saying that there's some other notables there that spoke to you.
Yeah. So some of the really big names were Her Majesty Queen Maxima of the Netherlands. And that was really neat, I think, because Queen Maxima, she was a very good speaker, and and her people there from the Netherlands, you can tell they just love her. But her and her husband are patrons of a shelter called Orange House, and they were involved in getting it up and running, I believe. But I read a little bit of that about that shelter, and it's one that's really interesting because it provides all of the services for survivors under one roof. Mm-hmm. So there's counseling, there's things for perpetrators, for the whole family that are available from this one organization, which is really innovative and different. But I thought that was just really neat that someone like Queen Maxima is not just delivering greetings and leaving. Right. You know, she was there for a bit, heard some of the other speakers, heard the survivors tell their stories, and she's actually involved in domestic violence work, which I think is so important and gives her so much credibility. And likewise with Princess Mary, the Crown Princess of Denmark, she, again, people love her, and she gave a very good talk, speaking about what needs to change to end violence against women and girls. But I sat next to some participants from Denmark in the audience at different times during the conference, and two of them said to me, oh, do you know what Princess Mary does for our shelters? And they told me about some innovative things that she has got going at the shelters and supports she provides, and she didn't mention those things in her speech. So she is, again, involved actually in doing domestic violence work. And I was so impressed because she didn't just come in, deliver her greetings and leave. She was there participating for the day prior to her talk as well. And she had a notebook and she was taking notes. Wow. And when I went to the conference in Washington, she was there too.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
So, you know, to have royalty that is actually engaged and learning and doing this, like, that's inspiring.
Mm-hmm. I was just wondering whether this is kind of an observation that I'm making. I wonder whether you agree with me that in Europe, it seems that government is taking a more active role in the social problem, solving social problems than what we see in our country. Would you agree with that?
You know, I'm sorry, I don't think I'm informed enough to actually agree or disagree. I mean, I heard a lot of things that sounded really, really positive during my short trip to the Netherlands, and some really interesting things that do seem like they're ahead, and they have some really great social programs going on. Yeah. I don't think it's always consistent from country to country, though.
Okay.
And I think there's some things we have here that they don't have.
Okay.
And then conversely, they have some things that we should really implement. But I definitely, I have a very good impression of how things are going there. I just don't think I know quite enough to comment.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why forums like this are so important, because this, of course, is frontline people, but there were government officials there too, from the Netherlands, and from South Africa, from Australia, from a number of places. And when the status of women minister from Australia stands up there and talks about all of these great things they've implemented in these multi-year plans in Australia, then government officials from other countries hear that. And then maybe that's where we get some of that exchange and that carryover, like what you're asking.
Usually, when you execute solutions like this to problems, there's a multiplier effect. You know, if you start caring for people properly, some of the other problems get looked after at the same time as unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I feel, you know, government spending on social programs really needs to be looked at in terms of increasing. And I think eventually we would get to a point where, you know, the problems are become far more manageable.
I absolutely agree with you. If we could have, number one, economic stability and financial kind of stability for women, you could give survivors real choices. People would be able to make a choice that works for them, and not to be forced into a choice based on finances or because of a lack of options. And that's just one example. But if we have social programs that impact things like housing and education, then we will do better as a society, and everyone is going to just come up and do better.
As a parting shot in the end of this conversation, I'd just like to mention that Finland has implemented, again, a guaranteed annual income.
I did hear that in the news, and that is fantastic.
So this is going to be wonderful. We tried it in Canada, in Dauphin, and as an experiment, but then the government changed, and that was the end of it. But they had a very good experience there, but nobody cared.
that is true. And see things like this in Finland, maybe that will work to influence policy around the world. Maybe here, maybe in other places in Europe, but it's a start.
For sure. Well, I'd like to thank both of you for being on Human Rights Radio, Crystal Giesbrecht and Samia Farah Ali, talking about very important issues. And we're hoping to see improvements in our neck of the woods here in the near future. But I think really good work is being done and can only improve. As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, founder of Amnesty International, said, "Only when the last prisoner of conscience has been freed, the last torture chamber has been closed, the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a reality for the world's people, will our work be done?"